Dr. Clark is the Medical Director of Women and Children's Clinical Services with the Hospital Corporation of America. He is really a significant mover and shaker in patient safety, and we're very pleased to have him here today. And he'll be talking about making obstetrics a high reliability profession. And welcome.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Ignacio always gives me a hard time that every time I show up, I'm wearing a loose-fitting tropical shirt. But when you live in Montana, you've got to take the opportunities you can to wear your two Hawaiian shirts. That was a magnificent presentation by Dr. Gluck. The problem is that every one of those slides could and should be turned into a day-long seminar, mandatory for every practicing obstetrician in the country. If we could do that, I think we would go a long way towards solving the patient safety problem. These are deep, complex issues that require a completely revised way of thinking. What I'm going to do is go through some of the same principles that Dr. Gluck has discussed, but bring the focus down one level now into how can we apply these general principles into our profession, and specifically I'll focus on obstetrics. Greetings from my hometown, where I live now, Twin Bridges, Montana. For those of you who can't read that, it says Twin Bridges, Montana, population 400. In fly fishing circles, it's what's known as a happening place. A high reliability organization is one which experiences fewer than the expected numbers of errors or accidents despite operating in an inherently risky environment. As Dr. Gluck mentioned, the commercial aviation industry is a prototype for that. You're flying a piece of multi-ton metal at 500 miles per hour, 40,000 feet above the ground, and yet most of us never give it a thought that we might, when we climb into one of these machines, that we're not going to land and walk away safely. The sad fact is that today in America, even in obstetrics, take a pregnant woman and put her in one of these flying machines, she has a far better chance of ending up with a healthy baby at the end of that flight than she does going to one of the hospitals in the United States and delivering a baby. And it shows you that we have a long way to come. Now, I'm not going to cover the Institute of Medicine report. Dr. Gluck did a great job of that. But I will mention a follow-up report by HealthGrades, which I found I won't even mention that one. I'll mention this one, which is one of my favorite articles. It was a kind of, in a sense, a follow-up to the IOM report, and said, how well have we done since that IOM report that came out in 1999? And the results were a classic mixture of good and bad news. The good news, they concluded that we have eliminated the variability in healthcare, the quality of healthcare, due to race, age, and gender. The bad news, today everybody gets equally crummy care, regardless of race, age, or gender. And in their sample, only about half of the patients which they sampled got the type of care recommended by their professional organizations. In obstetrics, we certainly have some things to be proud about, but there's a lot that we don't have to be proud about. If we understand that in decades, there's been no decrease in the rates of cerebral palsy, brachial plexus injury, maternal mortality, some studies suggest the maternal mortality rate may actually be increasing, but what is undeniable is that it has not decreased for 30 years. Preterm birth rate, we may now be seeing a slight downward trend following an upward trend for the past couple of years. And of course, all this comes with a rising cesarean delivery rate, which does not appear to be giving us better results. We rank 47th in infant mortality rate in the world, and two-thirds of infant mortality is perinatal mortality. Now, these should be sobering figures, and they translate with some differences into most other specialties in America. When we hear the politicians today pound the podium and say we have the best healthcare system in the world, the truth is we do not. By objective measurements, we do not. We pay twice as much for our healthcare system as anybody else in the world. That's true. And I would suspect for most people here sitting in the room who have money, who have insurance, and have the knowledge to navigate the difficult healthcare system, you and I probably do get the best healthcare in the world. But for the other 300 million people who are out in the United States, they simply don't, and the objective numbers in terms of most meaningful indices of outcome tell us that we don't. We have a problem. We need to address this. And as the Institute of Medicine said, to paraphrase them, we can't tweak the system. We can't change things around the edges. Trying harder will not work. Changing systems of care will. To all what should be all of our chagrin, we find, again, a quote from the Institute of Medicine, which is completely apropos to us, as they stated that most professional organizations, or many professional organizations, see their role as protecting their specialties from needed change rather than taking an active role in making what need to be actual revolutionary changes in healthcare if we are to change these things. Now, this also spills over into the role of medical malpractice, and I want to mention this just in one slide. I always think that there are two things in life that continue to just amaze me every time I think about it. One, how cute my granddaughters are. Number two, I've had over the course of 20 plus years a chance to consult with most major liability carriers. And we meet periodically and review all of the money that was paid in the past year. Okay, so you sit down. Now, this is the friendliest group of folks you'd ever meet. These are defense attorneys. These are insurance companies. These are defense consultants. And we sit down, close the doors, and go over all the money that was paid that year and ask the question, what percentage of this money was due to the fact that substandard care was given and caused an injury? And what percentage of the money was due to the injustices and imperfections of the medical malpractice system? The amazing thing is that year by year, company by company, the results turn out to be pretty much the same. This very friendly, positive group of people behind closed doors concur that 75% of the money paid deserved to be paid because the doctor or nurse or facility or system gave bad care and caused injury to the baby. That leaves us, of course, with 25% of cases that should not have been paid. But I'm convinced that one of the reasons we've not made as much progress as we would have liked to in beating the medical malpractice problem is that so often we focus our efforts in that red zone there, that red quartile, of unjustified lawsuits. Now, we've got to understand that red quartile is the home court of the most powerful organization in the United States, the American Trial Lawyers Association. Recall back 10 years when the Republicans controlled all branches of government and tried to push through meaningful tort reform legislation. What happened? Nothing. Why? The American trial lawyers beat the U.S. government. It's as simple as that. Are more powerful than the U.S. government in determining policy. And they will beat us every time if we're playing in their court. On the other hand, the big playing court is the blue area. That's our home field advantage, you see. That's the place where we give substandard care and cause injury. And if we were to focus our efforts there, we could potentially have a dramatic impact on the medical malpractice situation. We need to keep that in mind. Now, most of us are aware of the tremendous improvements in aviation safety that have come about in the past couple of decades. Some of us may not be aware that entire years go by. 2002 and 2004 are the most recent, in which there are no deaths in the entire world, on the entire planet, due to commercial aviation accidents. And this is with over 20 million annual takeoffs, and what I understand are supposed to be exactly the same number of landings. Can we say the same for preventable causes of cerebral palsy or Erb's palsy? We cannot. Now, realizing that many of these are not preventable, we got to understand that. That's also true. But I can't even say that, I think, for any individual hospital in the system that I work with, HCA, let alone make such a claim for our profession as a whole. So we've got to ask ourselves, what do these established high reliability organizations know that we don't? Dr. Gluck has done a great job of outlining a number of these things, and I'm just going to focus on two or three of them today. As Dr. Gluck mentioned, all the answers are here, and this is one of the things that drives me crazy. The answers are in these two textbooks. And these textbooks are not new, and you can order them on the internet, and they send them for a government service. They send them pretty darn promptly, as a matter of fact. Okay? The problem is that very few people have read these, and even fewer people take these things seriously. If you're interested in patient safety, it is mandatory that you get these books, that you read them, and that you study them just like you used to study textbooks in medical school, that you underline things, that you reread the underlined parts. It will change your life in terms of how you view our medical system. Now, I'm not going to go through these. Our approach at HCA, when we decided to do something about this almost a decade ago, you can read these as well as I can. Suffice to say that if you want to read more about these, we've kind of summarized our approach in these two articles in the Gray Journal, and they're in your handout for reference. The first thing I would like to focus on today is the issue of standardization of care. It seems to be a universal phenomenon, a universal characteristic of human beings, that whenever human beings are involved in any endeavor, whether it be making Toyotas, flying an airplane, generating nuclear power, or even playing professional baseball, that if you do it the same way every time, you're going to get a better outcome than if you do it different ways every time. And this principle appears to apply to medicine as well. Just as an example, this is an older plane, an MD-80. I don't care how many times this pilot has taken off. I don't care how experienced this pilot is and what a good record this pilot may have. Every single time, the pilot's going to go through the very, very same checklist. This is a more recent, this is the Delta MD-8890 operations manual that's in effect even right now. And I'm not going to go through all the details of what you do when the engine fails. This is what you do for engine failure. Except to look at the very top line here. Both pilots must identify the correct throttle and fuel lever switch prior to activating this protocol. Now, I point this out because it has some exact parallels. At HCA, for example, we have a postpartum hemorrhage protocol. One of the points of that says that any time anyone on the team estimates that the blood loss has been more than 1,500 cc's and the patient hasn't completely stopped bleeding, a second obstetrician must be called to the patient's bedside and is co-responsible for that patient's management until she is completely stable on the floor, stable vital signs, with no bleeding. Now, doctors initially hate this, and some still do hate this. What do you mean? You mean I'm a lousy doctor? I know how to manage postpartum hemorrhage. That's simply not the issue. It's just that in these crisis situations, two brains are better than one. And as we look at the maternal deaths that occur due to bleeding, what we find again and again and again is the definition of insanity attributed at least to Albert Einstein. That is persevering in one approach and expecting a different outcome to happen. A doctor continues to throw atenolol meds at the patient, and the other doctor may come in and say, you know, could this be retained placenta? Is that why the atenolol meds aren't working? Some other view here, some other person to come in and just jog our memory. We can all use that sort of thing, and we can take our cue from the airlines industry. Checklists are vital in the airline industry because another little known fact, when I get on the plane today to fly back to Montana, it is virtually impossible that that team flying my airplane has ever flown together before. Some of them may have flown together before, but that team has probably never flown together before. And yet they're going to be engaged in difficult maneuvers requiring close coordination where every team member has got to know what the others just did, what they're doing now, and what they're going to do a minute from now. This is not so different from obstetrics. We have changing personnel, changing shifts. We have the most experienced nurse in the hospital, and she's taken over her shift ends, and in comes a brand new nurse. And unlike the aircraft, the captain of the ship, us, we are often not even present when all of these things are going on. If the checklists have been important to aviation safety, and certainly the aviation safety people tell us that the checklists have been the very foundation of patient safety, checklists should be important to us. As Dr. Gluck mentioned, obstetrics is a team, not an individual sport. I won't go through the entire reason Swiss cheese model. Dr. Gluck did a great job of that, other than to point out that one other advantage of checklists is that they don't have that many holes in them. Okay, as we found out, the system breaks down when the holes line up. One of the things that we notice, and I've noticed over the years, is that many times when a lawsuit is filed, bad outcomes happen, everybody in the chart gets sued, okay? Now, there are a couple reasons for that. Surely the personal injury attorney wants to have a lot of pockets to draw money from. That's part of it. But there's another part that's actually true, and that is that if in many cases, not all cases, in many cases, if there weren't multiple screw-ups, the error would not have happened, okay? The doctor should be there, but his kid's soccer game is going a little bit longer and he just wants to watch it for another 15 minutes. And the nurse is worried about her daughter who's hanging out with the wrong crowd and maybe smoking pot. And the blood bank guy takes 5 minutes longer for lunch than he should. And the salve elevator's broken. Okay. And the patient bleeds to death, okay? Now, if any one of those things hadn't happened, the patient wouldn't bleed to death. It would have been fine, and she would have gone on, and she would have gone home, and there wouldn't have even been an adverse outcome. But you see, in a case like that, all the holes have lined up. The checklist is one of these barriers that has very few holes, because it never goes on break, it never gets distracted, and as someone else has said, the checklist never, ever forgets. This does not mean, and I'm not advocating, that every aspect of obstetric care be managed by checklists. There are 8 issues, and here they are, which make up 95% of preventable adverse outcomes in obstetrics and 95% of litigation in obstetrics. And there is absolutely no reason that we could not reduce every one of these things to checklist form, so that everyone in the United States is doing it exactly the same way every time, and it's defined as this is the way to be in compliance with the standard of care, and knock the top right off of medical malpractice litigation. More importantly, dramatically improve outcomes for our patients. Well, I can tell you this is not going to happen on a national level, okay? If it's going to happen, it's going to happen at a local level, such as this organization, such as Women's Care Florida, for example. That's where it's going to happen if it is to happen. Where do we begin? we've got to begin with the ACOG guidelines. Let's take an example of the current guidelines on the use of oxytocin. You can read through these, and you can see that these are fairly loose guidelines. They give broad latitude in terms of the administration of oxytocin. I liken these guidelines to the NFL rulebook. The NFL rulebook gives us certain parameters within which those players have to play. The field is so long, it is so wide, and the rule book tells us that the general idea is to move the ball down the field into the other person's goal. Okay? What the rule book does not tell us is how to deal with these guys. Okay? Now, every team in the NFL who's got to deal with these guys comes up with a certain plan based upon the personnel available, based upon the skills and the background and the experience and the things that that team can do well. And every team has some measure of success by working together in one given plan to move that ball down the field. Okay. Each team needs a specific plan and has a specific plan that governs the actions of every member in dealing with these folks. Because the surest way, if a member of a team, let's say it's the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, just as an example, a member of the team decides, you know, I used to play for the Bears, and we did it that way. And these Tampa Bay people, I know they want to do the offense this way, but we had a lot of success back in the day when I was with the Bears. I'm going to do it this way. That's the most certain way I know of for an offensive player to regain consciousness looking up at this site. Okay? That just doesn't work. Every team has some measure of success, and every team may do it a little bit differently, but they can only do it if they're all on the same page. And so it should be with our guidelines. Within the framework of those broad ACOG guidelines, for example, we took several years ago, we developed a very conservative checklist for the use of oxytocin. It was one way to be in compliance with those guidelines. It was not the only way to be in compliance with the guidelines. The reason that we instituted this, and I'm sure you've seen the checklist, basically if a nurse can count, the patient cannot be harmed by oxytocin. That's the basic story. We saw tremendous improvement in results. No increase in the length of any stage of labor, no increase in the rate of cesarean delivery, and improvement in every index of neonatal outcome, which we examined. And we did this by standardization. Understanding that there may be many appropriate ways to treat a condition, but when we're using a team approach, we need to pick one and get real good at it. The classic example in our specialty is Group B strep. I had a slide a few minutes ago that listed all these areas that we've made not great progress in. Yet we have reduced Group B strep from a real big problem to, that is early onset newborn Group B strep sepsis, to an almost reportable problem. We've made tremendous impact on that. Why do you think that is? Well, I'll tell you why it is. It's because every single doctor in this room does Group B strep exactly the same way, okay? The CDC, the American College, these people got together and said, here's how are you gonna do it? When will women be screened? 35 to 37 weeks. Was there really evidence that screening between 34 and 37 weeks was worse? Or that you couldn't screen even at 37 and a half weeks? No, there wasn't. How many orifices do you screen from? Two, what kind of culture medium do you use? It's spelled out in excruciating detail, okay? The reason we have eliminated this is because for once we didn't worry about saying we gotta pick the very best way, then in a cosmic sense, is an overriding best way to manage Group B strep. As a nation, we picked one really good way, and now every single year, 4 million women get screened in that exact way. And we've knocked the top right off of this. And that's the key to all of our success. Our success at HCA with oxytocin was not the brilliance of this protocol. It's that we picked one decent way to do it and then did it every single time in a quarter of a million patients every year. If I can leave you with any message, this is it. So I'm going to emphasize it again. This picture, this is looking off my front porch. Okay, and if you look upriver, there's a little gravel bank there. And one day the fishing was slow. Okay, and I sat down and wrote the oxytocin protocol that's now used in millions of thousands of hospitals around the country. Okay, now, because I wrote it, obviously there can't have been significant intellectual activity involved, nor was this undertaken after an exhaustive view of the literature, nor did I try to prove that this thing I came up with, two decelerations so deep in so many minutes you've got to turn off the pit and call the doctor, was better than anything. In fact, I'm absolutely certain that everybody in this room could have come up with an oxytocin protocol that was just as good as mine. Okay, I was not paralyzed by thinking, well, I can't do that because this other one might be just, wait, I can't do that because this other one might be just as good. I can't prove mine's better. We just picked one. We did it every time. And the results have been very, very gratifying. We need to avoid what I call best practice paralysis. Now, understand this carefully. Where best practice has been defined by the literature, we need to follow it. Okay? That's about five things in obstetrics. Okay, that is where there has been one way that's clearly been defined to be the best. We must follow evidence-based medicine. But in all, from hospital levels clear up to national committee levels, I find best practice paralysis enters in and is just killing us. Everybody will sit around the table and say, okay, let's do it this way. And then one person raises their hand and say, yeah, but what about the 34-year-old woman of Ukrainian descent with one leg who is blind in one eye and has sickle cell anemia and a history of malaria. That protocol won't work for her. And they say, oh, you're right. Ah, we can't do that protocol. Let's look for another protocol. Or somebody will say, well, you haven't proven that that's the very best protocol. Where's the prospective randomized double-blind placebo-controlled crossover trials showing that this approach is better than another approach, and they'll say, you're right, we can't, so we'll just say everybody do everything they want to do anytime they want to do it. That's best practice paralysis. If there are five equally good approaches, none of which is better than others, simply by picking one and having the team do it the same way every time, we will elevate one of those approaches and actually make it better than the other approaches were. Okay? If we can understand that concept, then we're going a very, very long way toward understanding the importance of protocols and checklists, getting past this best practice paralysis, and improving patient safety. Of course, exceptional circumstances, there's always deviations, but we do ask the physicians to simply write a note explaining their rationale for what they're doing. Okay. I'm a board-certified obstetrician, and no one's going to tell me how to manage my patients. I've heard that hundreds of times. Bad news, my friends. Yes, they are. Okay. Everybody's going to tell us how to manage patients. An article here in the New York Times last fall talked about this problem. And we can see this in neonatal and in the elective delivery before 39 weeks issue. For many, many years, we ignored the ACOG guidelines that have told us ever since I was a resident, you know, back in the centuries ago. That you're not supposed to deliver people electively before 39 weeks gestation. And we've ignored that. We ignored that to the point where it's costing the U.S. healthcare system over $1 billion annually to do that for worse outcomes. Okay. And now, as you all know, the boom has been lowered. Quite frankly, I would still like to have the ability to take that woman that I'm taking care of, whose husband's going to Afghanistan in 3 days, and who's only 38 and a half weeks gestation, and deliver her. I'd like to have that freedom. I do not. If my hospital is going to forbid me from doing that, and whose fault is it? It's mine. It's ours. Okay? We ignored the good advice of the college for 30 years, and the insurance companies, the other regulatory agencies had no choice because we refused to police ourselves. No choice but to step in and say, thou shalt not do it. I've lost some freedom to do that because I was afraid to do that. And let me tell you that in area after area after area, the vultures are gathering, okay? If we don't get together and we don't establish some of these protocols ourselves, we will find that this 39-week thing is nothing, okay? That'll look like Mickey Mouse compared to some of the things that some of the payers and some of the other regulatory agencies are now looking at to essentially establish a forcing function to force us to do what we should have been doing the entire time. Okay, now we're gonna skip through this because I want to talk about a couple of, first of all, let me point out that the Patient Safety Foundation established by the Florida Women's Health Group. I've reviewed that information. I've gone through that. It's fabulous, okay? And I wonder, where do these guys come from, okay? Why can't I get these guys in all the other hospitals and HCA? This is a wonderful, wonderful program. And those protocols are great, and the leadership is exactly on target here. My strongest recommendation is that you jump behind these men and women and follow them and help them and support this process. Dr. Glock mentioned near miss, and I'm going to wrap it up here by talking about some data. This is we have a paper in press in the Gray Journal, which is the first report systematic analysis of near misses in obstetrics. And this is the very first time I presented this data, so it is brand new. A near miss is a medical error that has the potential to reach the patient and cause harm, but does not. These are much more common than actual harm events. If we analyze near miss events, we can identify hazards prospectively and take steps to avoid them, rather than simply respond in a knee-jerk fashion to injuries that have already occurred. And the beauty of that is we can then avoid making changes that interfere with workflow to avoid events that may not happen again for years. You've probably seen this in departments. There's a maternal death because somebody did something. And because of that, we've got to do thousands of patients. We've got to manage them differently to prevent something which wouldn't happen again in decades anyway. This is irrational response to an adverse event. It's much better to find these problems before they occur and change the processes then. We can do it much more efficiently. So we have a system of voluntary reporting of near-miss events, and we collected in the year 2010 463 events that occurred on labor and delivery. And we gave them a little scoring system, okay? They were scored 1 to 5 based on the worst possible outcome. They were given a score based on whether the error was detected by luck or by a system that was in place for detecting error. They got a score of 1 or 2 based on the number of barriers that were in place to prevent the error from causing harm, and then also a score of 1 or 2 based on whether the quality of the barriers was excellent or not so excellent. And then we multiplied this all together and came up with what we call a hazard index. And here's the raw data. Medication error was far and away the most frequent, and patient ID error, which goes along with medication error, far and away the most common types of errors. Yet because we had in place good barriers, they rarely reached the patient. going down. Well, we'll talk about some of these different types of errors. So what we did is put all of these types of errors into a little plot like this, where hazard index and frequency, and you got low, low, high, high, low, high, low, high sort of situation, and then analyzed them. And we found that they fell into four categories. There were the high-frequency, low-hazard events, such as medication and patient identification errors. These are common errors, but effective barriers, at least in our system, appear to be in place to prevent these errors from reaching the patient and causing harm. The take-home lesson here is we don't need to invest a great deal of additional resource in preventing medication errors, but we do need to understand that the subsurface iceberg is huge. And we need to emphasize to our nurses that we are just barely missing these errors because of our barriers in place. Because few of these errors reach the patient and cause harm, one could become complacent in double-checking the wristband, for example, and double-checking the medication, doing all of these steps that many of you have in your hospitals. We need to emphasize, and we are emphasizing to our nurses, we cannot become complacent here, because lurking just behind those barriers, you know, the barbarian hordes are massed north of the Rhine River, and by golly, they're just about to come over the border on us if it were not for the barriers we have in place. So don't let down on the barriers. Then we have the high frequency, high hazard errors. For example, physician failure to respond. These are common errors where we have poor barriers in place to prevent harm, and we really do. What do you do when you call the doctor and says he's going to finish the ball game before he comes for the bradycardia? What do you do? How do you put a barrier in place for that sort of thing? Well, there are some approaches, but they're not nearly as easy, and we haven't fixed that problem. Okay, that's a high frequency, high hazard sort of barrier. So we need to put major attention in our patient safety efforts in our system toward that sort of error. They're low frequency, high hazard errors. What do you do when the doctor just reaches in with the scissors and cuts the wrong artery? Okay, this doesn't happen very often. It's a high hazard sort of thing. So physician performance error is an example of the low frequency, high hazard sort of thing. And again, poor barriers in place to do that. And then there was low frequency, low hazard errors, charting errors, for example, uncommon errors where, again, we have effective barriers in place to prevent harm. But I think you can see this sort of analysis has allowed us to say, where are we doing well? Where do we need to focus, rather than just go off half-cocked in 1,000 directions trying to basically address general patient safety? Finally, one other important issue, and that is the issue of perinatal metrics. And I promised I would mention this. These are the current perinatal metrics that are being collected by Joint Commission. Now, having been on the NQF panel that helped develop these, I can tell you that basically these were developed because they're relatively easy to collect electronically. Okay? Not because they're very important. And a lot of people get upset about these metrics because they say, quite properly, these are trivial. It's not that they're not important. It's just that in the real world of dead and damaged babies and dead and damaged mothers and premature births and all the things we're dealing with, these metrics fall somewhere in the second 100 topics of concern that we're concerned with every year. But they're easy to develop. They're easy to measure, and so there we have it. Okay. Do not be dismayed, do not be put off or discouraged by the fact that the current metrics that we're asked to collect are in fact relatively trivial in the big scheme of things. Okay. We have a crazy profession where the process information is all contained in one patient's chart, the mother, and the outcomes information is all contained in another patient's chart, the baby, And most current EMRs and record systems in the country don't allow cross-linking of mother and baby. So we really can't link the processes with the outcomes. Very, very different than most other specialties. I think over time, as EMRs improve, we'll be able to get more important metrics. But I can tell you that at HCA right now, the nation's largest provider of healthcare, there is absolutely nothing more important. The entire system seems to have been upset on its head, directed to one end: do well on the metrics. Okay, and these are the Joint Commission metrics for all the different specialties. Why? Because this is absolutely, they may not be the most important clinical issues in medicine, but they are becoming the most important financial issues in obstetrics. They will drive reimbursement. And stay tuned as new ones come up. So when your leaders come out and your hospitals say, we've got to collect these metrics, please don't blow them off. Okay. Take this very, very seriously, because this is going to determine who gets paid. We were meeting with one of the big payers a few weeks ago, who pointed out to us that if they could just get rid of the bottom either 5 or 10%, bottom 5% of performers, they could improve, they could increase everybody else's reimbursement by 14%, and still increase their very own profit. Okay, and how are they going to determine the bottom 5% of the performers?
By
the metrics, okay? You cannot take this lightly. It's not hitting us today, it will hit us tomorrow. And if you're smart, you'll put yourself in a position to be well set when the companies decide to finally get real serious about this. All right. So, has this approach paid off? It has. Here is a chart which shows the frequency trends of claims per 10,000 births in HCA. We have 2010 data is in, and actually 2011 data. I don't know how I got this older slide. It's now somewhere, it's about three now. So it's fallen even lower. This trend has continued. Now, this trend, this is not money lost in malpractice suits. This is claims filed. So what it is, it's an arbiter of, if fewer claims are filed, it's because fewer bad outcomes are happening. Okay, and we think this is a very good arbiter of the quality of care that we're giving. Since we instituted these programs almost a decade ago, we have seen a continued drop in these rates to a very, very low level, where in most years, OB litigation now in our system ranks behind accidents on hospital grounds in terms of economic cost to HCA. Last year was an exception because we paid even less in OB claims, but it was a really mild winter and not many people slipped and fell on the ice. So by about $50,000, accident on hospital claims actually cost us less than OB cases. Either way, I go to the leaders of our company and talk to them about how they've got to fund these programs because of the OB malpractice crisis, and they look at me like I'm crazy. They say, "What OB malpractice crisis?" And they point out quite correctly, their money would be much better spent on more salt for the driveways, than fighting a non-existent OB malpractice crisis. It doesn't hit our radar screen. And this is the largest healthcare organization, a delivery organization in the United States. Okay. Now, one of the things that I also mentioned before in one of those early slides is I have told our doctors everywhere, I don't care about the C-section rate. It's irrelevant. Okay. To stay off of my radar screen, you need to send home healthy mothers with healthy babies. That's what I care about. Now, I will never get on your case for your C-section rate. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, we did have a hospital with a 78% C-section rate, and I had to get on their case. Okay, I lied. Okay, but other than that one example, we haven't. We really haven't. Okay, because I'm convinced that shooting for any arbitrary C-section rate is a fool's errand. When we are doing every component of OB care perfectly, then the perfect C-section rate will fall out of the sky. Okay. That's the only way to approach it, piece by piece by piece. Now, with this very laissez-faire, I don't care what the section rate is, you would expect our section rate to have gone through the roof. What's actually happened? Okay. And again, 2011 data was just below that 20% line. Here's our primary cesarean rate for HCA since we began this this process of, we don't care what your section rate is, we just care if you give good obstetrical care. We have knocked the top right off the primary cesarean rate, and year by year, the rate has slowly fallen and fallen, something that's not been seen in any other area of the country. And this is with not a mention of, we've got to reduce our cesarean section rate, okay? We can do the same thing. The key is in good, safe care, as instituted in the Patient Safety and Quality Institute of Women's Care Florida, best practice and protocols. I've reviewed these protocols, and I'll mention again, they are absolutely great, and the ones that are going to be developed are equally great. They're going to do a great deal to promote the quality of healthcare here in Florida. So with that, I thank you very much, and hope these remarks will be of assistance to you.